man. There's a beverage here, huh?
Does anybody here know how many times I've had to watch Funny Lady?
I'm gonna get that gun of mine, and I'm gonna change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Who Shot Ya? Episode 167, if you're counting. And it's going hard. And of course, your faves are here. And this time we have a super dope guest. So let me introduce everyone so you can get your brain ready to inject all this delicious cinema knowledge that we're going to drop. So first up, let's talk to Alonzo Duralde. Alonzo, what's good?
I'll tell you what's good, Iffy. Blow molds. And oh, if you don't know what that is. So before inflatables took over the lawn holiday display action, there was a thing called blow molds. And those are those big plastic, you know, lit from within, you know, Santas or snowmen or candles or choir boys or whatever the heck. And, you know, because the inflatables are the thing now, blow molds, harder to find. You kind of often have to go the vintage route. And frankly, they're just better. Like, I've never, inflatables never meant shit to me, but I do love a blow mold. And we just bought our first one to decorate our festive holiday balcony. And so I'm super psyched. You know, Christmas is happening. We have a blow mold.
Ooh, okay.
Wait, what's it in the shape of?
It is a Santa.
Okay, duh. So you, it's in the shape of you. Okay.
The next person that we're going to introduce is none other than the illustrious, wonderful queen of the Midwest, Drea Clark. Drea, what's good?
What's good is just the pleasant jolt of energy that I hear the words blow mold and it's from Alonzo and not you. That was a fun twist. The other thing that's good with me, as I think I've mentioned before, we had a guest on the show. He's been on now twice, Mike Kaplan. Mm-hmm. We talked about driveways with him and then we talked about lingua franca. And so I've only met him over Zoom and we struck up a very fun friendship and have become pen pals. And I was on his podcast this week because everyone has a podcast, as they should. And yeah, so that comes out the same day as this episode. It's called Broccoli and Ice Cream, which is the most Mike Kaplan thing because you talk about like the good stuff, the hearty stuff that has the vitamins, and then also, you know, the sugary sweet stuff. So that was really fun for me.
Ooh. Was there a topic or was it just a free for all?
The topic was Drea Clark.
Okay.
Yeah, just a real deep dive. It was my Oprah interview.
It was 7 hours long.
On my friend Mike Kaplan's podcast. The exact level of fame I have always hoped to achieve and never hoped to leave. Yeah.
Oh, I love it. You love to see it, as some would say. And I'm going to just keep the ball rolling so we can talk to screenwriter, filmmaker Michael Verratti. What's good?
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. And what's good? Kylie Minogue's new album, Disco.
Yes.
That's what's good because it's, you know, releasing that album during election week. It's like she said, I know you all have a dance party coming and here it is. Like she provided the tunes and luckily she was right because there was some dancing in the streets. So.
Kylie Minogue not only gifted the world with a new CD, the Saturday night she had a global concert that she recorded. That you could stream on the various continents. And I must say, like, for all the thrills of Saturday after Election Day, the Infinite Disco show really capped off the day really well. I only watched it because I'm married to a Kylie Minogue fanatic, but I enjoyed every second of it.
No, but I have to say, for decades, Kylie has just gave and gave and gave. And the fact that America still is not fully on board with the Minogue locomotion train, if you will.
Yeah, what are we even doing here? Yeah, they're saying that this new album is supposed to hit number one in the UK, and if it does, she will be the only artist to have a number one album in 5 subsequent decades. So, like, give it up.
Oh, my God. Yeah, she really is a prince among
men. Iffy, what's good?
Oh, what's good with me? I can say many a things, you know, like buying a new 120 millimeter medium format camera. I could, you know, talk about, you know, the release of the Xbox and PS5 that Amazon fucked me out of. But, you know, we're not going to get into that. But what I want to talk about, because, you know, we went in to our last record unsure, and now we are sure that, you know, Joe Biden is the president-elect. And of course, you know, as expected, is this is the, like, I was explaining this to someone being like, oh, now they're doing this. And I was like, yeah, but this was the best case scenario, is that Biden wins, they waste our time for a month. All the states have to confirm legally by the 20th. So even though Georgia has said that they want to do hand recounts, which will still be in his favor, you know, we now know that, you know, the president is being flushed out of office. It's just one of those flushes you have to keep hitting a couple of times. And then maybe you grab the little, like, little brush to be like, oh, I'm over a date's house. They can't know I'm dropping bombs like this.
America is a water-saving toilet.
Yeah, America is a water saver. So I'm feeling good. I'm in good spirits. And I say all that to say there was a moment in that like night when I had friends over, when everyone was leaving, and I walked out and I felt the cool, brisk air. And like, I didn't even realize how much of a weight, you know, these past 4 years were, because like, I felt good and I looked and the house across me had Christmas lights. And I was like, oh, it actually feels like Christmas. So yeah, I'm gonna get Christmas lights. I'm going all out this year. We're getting the big tree for it to be abandoned on the sidewalk sometime in January.
Nice. May I add a small, in light of having people over, to everyone listening, please don't have people over. COVID numbers are skyrocketing, and we want you all to be safe. And
yes.
I know this because I know Iffy is like a very conscientious person, so whatever he did was under like strict whatevers.
Yeah, but the hospitals are packed again.
Like, numbers are rising. This was not a fake thing that the world made up so the Democrats would have an edge. Like,
yeah, no, it's very real. It's happening.
Yeah,
we're going
make
into
good
a
choices.
Yeah, it was wild too, because a couple of weeks ago I remember watching New York getting all their outdoor dinos. Like, man, they're getting it in. Maybe they have it figured out. And then I was like, oh no, it looks like we're back.
No, and then. But, as of the time of this recording, last night we all got in LA that alert on our phones. Did that scare anyone else? You
know? Yeah.
Oh. I was like, we got an Amber Alert for the entire state. Yeah.
It was like, yo, for
I
real,
turned mine off. I didn't know that was that happened.
Yeah, there was a whole Amber Alert that was basically like, yo, the numbers are rising. Please stay inside.
Wear a mask. Stay inside. Yeah. Don't be around people. Social
distance.
Yeah,
get tested regularly. Stay focused. That's everyone who came, you know, luckily we're all, because the industry is slowly trying to ramp back up, getting tested every week. No, you know, and then, you know, quarantine, be safe, be smart about it. Speaking of outbreaks and pandemics and all this stuff, today is marking the first episode in our mini series covering the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy, which means we're starting with the first movie in that trilogy, Shaun of the Dead. Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute is back with a vengeance. And of course, we have our staff picks. But first, it's time for our news segment, Itadic, short for Is This Important? Do I Care? Each of us will read a news segment and answer the question, is this important? Do I care? And first, Chris Rock was recently on the How Neil Feel podcast and discussed his hatred for civil rights movies. Let's listen to the clip.
I hate all civil rights movies.
What?
Don't get me wrong. I applaud the effort.
Right.
And they should exist. The problem is, they only show the back of the bus and the lunch counter. They actually make racism look very, like, fixable.
Right.
And they don't really get into how dysfunctional the relationships were. I always tell the story of my mother used to get her teeth taken out at the vet.
Yeah.
Because you weren't allowed to go to the dentist. Like no movie shows you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is this important? Do you care?
Well, here's a thought, Chris Rock. How about you make that movie?
That's true. Chris Rock is a fantastic filmmaker, too.
Let's not go crazy.
He's like Fast Five.
Top Five.
Not Fast Five. No, but I also really like Fast Five.
I like Fast Five, too. He had nothing to do with
it. It's a good place to remind people of that, yeah.
I will never forgive Top Five for making Boo a Madea Halloween happen. That's right. That was a joke in that movie, and Tyler Perry's like, oh, say, there's an idea. And then we got two of those movies. So thanks a lot, Chris Rock. I hear what he's saying, and it certainly makes sense. But, you know, I think it was Jean-Luc Godard who said the best way to review a movie is to make another movie. And yeah, it's like, it's one thing for a critic to say, yeah, here's a problem with these films, but Chris Rock, you're an actual filmmaker. Go make that movie if you want to see that movie.
He has so many valid points, and there is this frustration of Black stories in general when there's not enough of them, and the ones we see are continually concentrated on like two specific points in history, and yes, Black people are always tremendously oppressed in them because they were and continue to be, but also as if that's the only thing that they have as a people, as a race. It's just this like, there's nothing else. The other annoying part is there are films that bring up terrible subjugations. Like The Help has an entire storyline about how the African American maids in it, one of the driving things is about how they want them to have different toilets because they don't want them in the same bathroom. So they're making these little toilets in the backyards, like little baby sheds for their maids, which is such a demeaning and specific kind of thing, which is exactly what he's talking about. I say this not as a defender of The Help per se, but there is. If he's going to make it, there's so many details, but I can also see not wanting to. I could see if I was a Black filmmaker, no, I'd rather make top five. I'd like to romance Rosario Dawson, thank you.
He is totally right in that these movies tend to portray racism in this country as being like the fault of a few mean white people, and if we could just win them over, it'd be fine. And you're right, there's this much deeper sort of systemic racism that goes on, and movies tend to ignore that sort of thing in favor of narratives that make people feel good about themselves and let white audiences off the hook for thinking that they're not that white person.
Well, and I think from a film going and filmmaking perspective, this is one of those discussions where, for me, I really don't have a place to comment on this because that is not my history or my experience. So if Chris Rock has issue with this, I think that's a very legitimate thing. Like, and I think that, you know, those are very valid critiques.
No, as a Black.
No, here's the thing with this.
Please never use that as a noun again.
There are so many like levels to this. One, we're talking about within this like current renaissance of Black filmmaking, we have a Black audience that is so tired of these stories of oppression. So that's one reason we're not going to see these stories. Two, I think something that everyone kind of wants to hit on, but you know, doesn't feel comfortable saying, we go to movies to like feel good. Like it doesn't have to be like, we don't see all of the Holocaust. We don't see all of, you know, like it's like there's an element of where there, I personally feel there are things that belong in movies that we're telling stories and things that belong in documentaries and history books. And I think when you kind of force that down audiences' throats and I think there are ways to do it, but I do think it's not something that you can see. Like the thing that Chris Rock described, that's something subtle that I imagine you could throw into a period piece that's nothing about racism that would be this oh snap moment. Right. Or you can just hit it with it like in the way we did it in Watchmen, how a lot of people didn't know about the Tulsa riots or the Tulsa massacre, I'll say, because of, and you just show it. Is he's just doing the comedian thing of like, here's a bit, like I'm gonna frame this in a way to say something, but I'm gonna be like, but to catch your attention, I'm gonna say, I don't like civil rights movie because that's gonna make your ears perk up. And then I'm gonna hit you with this like real truth of things that happen. But that's what I truly think it is. And I think it started a discussion because Twitter loves to have those. but yeah, I think in the general discussion of it, I think there are elements of what he said that can take place, but I don't think we're ever going to see that raw civil rights top to bottom oppression, because I do think at this point in filmmaking, Black audiences are a little fatigued. maybe.
Well, that's another good point of it. Those films are not often made for black audiences. Yeah, they're made for white audiences. Not all of them, of course, but like to understand or acknowledge a part of history that they don't or whatever.
I love the Amber Ruffin tweet where she says, "Me, I'm so tired of black trauma. Lovecraft Country, how about spooky black trauma? Me, LOL, okay."
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. Put some Cthulhu in it and then maybe I'll check it out.
Hey, guys, speaking of trauma, I have news about Johnny Depp.
Oh, do tell.
No?
I'm in. I'm here for it.
All right, you guys, I'm really getting good at segues. In an open letter published on his Instagram page, so you know it's legit, Johnny Depp has announced that he resigned from the upcoming Fantastic Beasts sequel at the request of Warner Brothers Studio. In recent years, Depp has been accused of domestic abuse by ex-wife Amber Heard, which led to a recent lost libel suit against him. Depp will still be paid his entire undisclosed eight-figure sum, so he's really taking it on the chin with this.
Ouch.
Even though he only shot one scene for the sequel. Again, eight figures, if you want to write out what numbers look like. Some rumors are pointing to Mads Mikkelsen taking over the character of Grindelwald, the evil wizard, which was formerly played by Johnny. I call him Johnny, I guess. Also, J.K. Rowling is a huge transphobe. Make sure you know that. Is this important? Yes, do you care?
No. It is important and I don't care.
Yes.
Go ahead, Michael. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, no. I think that this is kind of one of those things where Johnny Depp's bad behavior and J.K. Rowling's appalling language and agenda aside, it's sort of like these movies kind of feel like the dead horse beaten. Like, there's already issues here that, you know, take a break. As with every major franchise, like, I feel fatigued. I was fatigued before everyone turned out terrible. And now that they're terrible, it's even more like, just like, go home. Go home.
No, I totally agree. I was not on the Fantastic Beast train even before everyone turned out to be a total nightmare.
This is a cast of, like, 45 okay, people.
You're right. Many of them are lovely people. But before J.K. Rowling like really showed her hand and Johnny Depp went down his particular rabbit hole, I was already not on board because these movies are boring. You're right. This is just additional incentive to never buy a ticket to any of these.
I do think it is. I liked how Alonzo phrased it, that it's important and I do not care. The do not care is largely because of there is an overall sense of fatigue over this as a franchise. However, it does incredible box office and has massive fans, and they're going to keep making them. So what is important to me is that Warner Brothers, that there's something of note of just, we watch so many bad people never face consequences all the time. Right. And especially in areas like this, that is still like Johnny Depp can make arguments of how it's a gray area. The reason that, you know, the catalyst for this is he lost a libel suit against probably The Sun, but some outlet that had written about how he was abusive towards his...
I think it was The Sun, yeah.
Of course, it was The Sun.
It's always
and
The Sun.
It's always The Sun. And he lost it because he basically couldn't prove that he didn't, and there's all of this evidence that he did. And so it is that still kind of gray area of like, well, no one really knows. Like, we let the gray area slide in so many ways in this industry. So for me, of especially a franchise that's for children, I think that that's important to be making people reckon. And also the fact that he wrote it into his thing of like, I have been asked to resign, and so I accepted the oddness of,
with my platinum parachute,
appreciate my acquiescence.
Right. And I think you raised a good point earlier about how there are a lot of people who make a movie and a lot of good people worked on these movies. And I generally, as someone who is a filmmaker and not a critic, kind of make a policy to not knock movies because, you know, I know what goes into them. And I know that like a lot of work goes into it. And I don't know the behind the scenes generally. But for an overall sense, this is one of those things where it seems to like it has so many infractions that it's like, okay, if you want to do this right and also do right by the people in the movie who are working hard and trying to do something good, sometimes it's important to just take a knee and take a rest. You can come back to it, but clean house first. That's all.
Yeah, that, I know. It's very interesting because, like, you're so right. There are so many, like, asterisks to this story where, like, it's kind of trying to be put out as if you could tell it's this move to, like, save face. But it's like, all right, but you're still being paid, whatever. You're off the movie. And this whole Johnny Depp thing has been interesting because it's one of those kind of, like, you know, stan culture adjacent things where you have a group of people who so badly, and this happens for a lot of, you know, celebrity abusers, is you have people who so badly need this person to be innocent, so badly, so any little bit. So when the news came out that Amber Heard would hit him too, then it became like, oh, she's a complete liar and all this stuff. And like, there's just so much around this that people just want it to be great. And Edward Scissorhands did not slap that hard.
Back it up. Don't bring Edward Scissorhands into this.
Yeah, there is a side of his fandom that is the defensive side of his fandom that is really disconcerting to encounter on the internet.
Yeah, it's just really hard. I mean, but you almost see it too when, I mean, if have you ever tried to tweet anything including the name Michael Jackson?
Because
no. you're no matter who you are, your notifications will be destroyed. It's wild, you know?
I gave a bad review to a Dakota Johnson movie once, I can attest.
Any fandom.
Once you ruffle a fandom, it's
I hate it, but I do need the Iffy Nation to rise up. I would love the Iffy Nation to stand behind me.
Oh Lord.
All right, well, on that that note, we're gonna take a breather and leave our notifications. Do not at anyone on this pod. We'll find you. All right, but we're gonna take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking about Shaun of the Dead just as soon as we hear from another one of the shows on Maximum Fun.
Hello there, ghouls and gals. It is I, April Wolf. I'm here to take you through the twisty, scary, heart-pounding world of genre cinema on the exhilarating program known as Switchblade Sisters. The concept is simple. I invite a female filmmaker on each week and we discuss their favorite genre film. Listen in closely to hear past guests like The Babadook director, Jennifer Kent, Winter's Bone director, Deborah Granick, and so many others every Thursday on MaximumFun.org. Tune in if you dare.
It's actually a very thought-provoking show that deeply explores the craft and philosophy behind the filmmaking process while also examining film through the lens of the female gaze. So, like, you should listen.
Switchblade Sisters.
Welcome back to Who Shot You? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Drea Clark,
Michael Verratti,
Alonzo Duraldi.
And today we're talking about Shaun of the Dead. Alonzo, would you mind providing us with a synopsis?
So Simon Pegg stars as Sean, who works in an electronics store and is, you know, your classic man child. His girlfriend would like him to get his act together and stop smoking and to go back to the gym and take her someplace beside the neighborhood pub. But he goes through every day kind of the same. And one day when he goes through everything kind of the same, he eventually discovers that, oh, my God, there's a zombie outbreak. And so it's up to him and his best friend, Ed, who is an even bigger slacker than Sean is, to rescue the girlfriend and the mom and various other people in an attempt to stay alive. Like we will see a lot as we talk about the Cornetto trilogy, this is a movie about masculinity in crisis disguised as a genre film.
Nice. Mm. Look at you. Ooh, slipping that in.
I know. Well, I mean, to kick this discussion off, I'm going to ask y'all a question. Do you find more or less enjoyment watching zombie movies now that we're in a pandemic?
Just a natural, easy flowing question.
Yeah,
from
you know, just, you know, light, light.
It's like going to the D-Box.
Yeah, it was interesting. I'm assuming we've all seen Shaun of the Dead before, if not numerous times before.
Yes.
And so rewatching this, it is this comfortable film that has like so many, but there's also new, like, I forgot how clever and whatever, but the pandemic side of it, there's things that you notice differently now. Like, I mean, certainly there's things every time I see actors lean in close to each other, I'm like, he is talking so close to that other guy's face. Oh my God. All that stuff, breath just lingering. But the idea of the banality of routine is actually, that's the part that's different now, because as much as you have routine, all of our routines are upended in so many ways that I was like, ugh, what I wouldn't give to just be able to stagger across to the bodega and pick up a snack and then just casually walk back here and then go to my office. So I was cognizant of certainly my own beautiful zombie tendencies, but it was this weird thing of being jealous of these people, even when they were in their outbreak of like, oh my gosh, look how they're just all, they all get to go to the bar together. They're all going to shelter in a bar, like with a group of people. Those lucky bastards.
Oh my gosh.
I had not rewatched this movie since 2004. I mean, I liked it a lot. I just hadn't gotten around to revisiting it. So it's that thing of like, oh, all these actors who I now know in the interim playing like three line roles, like there's Tamsin Grieg and there's Matt Lucas staggering at the end as the, you know, the guy in the other group or whatever. So just like, there was a lot of IMDb like, oh, I forgot this person was in that. But it's also interesting, I think, to look at this. Yeah, the pandemic thing was definitely on my mind for a lot of it. But also just the notion of, and it was the same when we talked about the Before movie, sort of once you've seen the subsequent films, how you look at what, how that changes the lens through which you look at the first one.
I was just going to say the other thing, and it's not pandemic related, so then I'll bridge off and give you, and I'll give you no clean segue, Michael. But the in revisiting this, I will, before I forget it, his style, I forgot that, like, that Edgar Wright sets up a visual style and language for himself with this film, and that filters into his future work. And then I've certainly seen replicated or attempted to be replicated by many, many people. And that stood out to me even more this time. And then there was the pandemic. Michael?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, actually, you know, what you're saying, the idea of pandemic and Edgar Wright's style tie in very well together, because making a zombie movie, the reason we see so much zombie media is because, by and large, in terms of genre horror and genre films, they're one of the easier ones to make, because mm-hmm. you just get some extras, you throw some grease paint on, and now you have a palatable threat. Unfortunately, easy to make doesn't always mean easy to watch. And the truth is the best zombie movies always work allegorically. That's why George Romero really, truly exceeded in this genre, whereas so many other people failed, because he knew that the zombies could represent so much more. And what's really working here with Edgar Wright, and why I think it applies to the pandemic, is because how he structures the film. Every minor character that you see at some point, you see again as a zombie. Mm-hmm. Instead of just having random extras, it's the man with the silver-toed boots. It's like the zombie in the yard that, you know, when Sean and mm-hmm. Ed are first attacked, is the checkout girl that we meet in the montage at the beginning. And if you're not paying attention, you don't realize. So he's really showing how this affects the world that they live in, and how it kind of always comes back. And that, to me, is a great representation of a pandemic, because you can't divorce yourself from something that's happening in your neighborhood, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I think it also... Oh, that was good. I'm going to just pause. That was good, Michael. That was good. You tied that in so good.
And this also, you should really get into writing. The way your words brought a fire into my soul.
I think this, and this is something we'll get to a lot, I think, with Hot Fuzz, but, you know, over the course of sort of film history, you can sort of see where, like, this director leads to that director. Like, you know, so much of Martin Scorsese pops up in Spike Lee, for instance. And I think when you look at, especially the Cornetto trilogy, there's so much Robert Zemeckis going on here. Like, the level of setup, payoff, that you see in a movie like Back to the Future, where he is just scattering all these seeds and they're all going to like bloom later in the third act. He's doing that throughout the movie. You're right. Like the fact that, every minor character we see winds up being a zombie. The fact that just all these bits of dialogue or business or whatever, like there's such a structure here, you know, and it's funny because I think a lot of times these films get lumped into, say, the Judd Apatow comedies because they are about, you know, like they're coming of age groups movies for full grown men. Whereas Apatow's movies are so often loose and improvisational and seemingly thrown together in a lot of ways, like there is so much structure happening here. Like he is really creating this system of girders upon which the rest of the movie lies.
Oh yeah. I mean, just to piggyback off of Alonzo, what he just said is there's just so much beautiful repetition. You see so many things done over and over again, either in the same scene as a joke or even, you know, this interaction when they're alive, jokey foreshadowing, like the kid who hits him with a soccer ball and he's like, "You're dead." And the first thing is when they step outside and the kid is a zombie and he hits him with the soccer ball. That is what's so fun. And, you know, I am not the biggest fan of Cinema Sins, but I found this channel called Cinema Wins, where they're like, and I like their motto. Their motto is like, movies are more fun when you enjoy them. And yes. So they just point out their favorite things, and they have a really good, pointing out all the different points. And it really is like great. Like he pointed out like in the scene when he's in the bodega in Hindi, it's saying the zombies are attacking. This is not a prank. I think the fun of this movie is how much it's less about them finding out about a zombie outbreak and more them being too dumb to realize there's one going on. And then when it hits them, they're like, oh.
And it's so brilliantly layered, I think is what you're saying. Like the idea of having this broadcast telling us everything we kind of need to know, but if you don't speak Hindi, you're in the dark, just like Sean and Ed are in the dark. And I think that, you know, it became very in vogue during that era of filmmaking to be very pop culture referential in the movies that you made. But this is an example of how to do it well, mm-hmm. as opposed to how not to do it, because mm. this movie all throughout has brilliant cues to horror cinema and zombie movies and all sorts of things.
We're coming to get you, Barbara!
Oh, so good.
And they don't do the thing where they're just like, we said a name of the movie, so the audience yes. is like, oh, there it is. They just build it in. Like the fact that at the very end, you know, the military unit, it says Biohazard, which is the name of the Resident Evil franchise in Japan. All you know,
the fish restaurant is Fulci's.
Yeah. But one of my favorite things that they built in is the fact that Yvonne, who is part of the other group that eventually rescues them, Jessica Hine, was Simon Pegg's partner on Spaced. So they're like literally, we know that they're having this parallel adventure. They're just saying, and you just know that she's doing it better somewhere else.
Yeah.
speaking of, that's the group that Alonzo was talking, because there's multiple partners in that. Like Tamsin Grieg and Dylan Moran, who's in Simon Pegg's team, were obviously both in Black Books, and there's all of these multiple pairs. There's someone else in that.
Martin Freeman
and Lucy Davis, yeah. Of course. So like, there's these beautiful. I love their Scooby Doo lineup of those. The teams matching each other.
Yeah. Like Simon Pegg, I don't think gets his due as a writer, as well as an actor. I mean, like in this movie, he is called upon to like do such a gamut of emotions, and for a movie that people might think, oh, it's a goof on zombie movies, it's a parody on zombie movies, like he has to shoot his mother, and he gives that moment like all the weight that it merits. And I think, you know, and again, like really, I'm here for The World's End. Like that's the one I'm super pumped to talk about. But like all these movies are great in their own ways, and I think that his writing with Wright like brings so much of this stuff, the layers of the genre stuff, and the really kind of underlying storytelling about these men and their friendships and their way of coping or not coping with the world around them, and how that gets shaken up by these sort of genre movie style big events.
And I think just piggybacking on what you've all said, and I don't know if it's something that I noticed new this time, because obviously it's been the content of what we've been talking about this whole time, But it's just the attention to detail that really makes this work. Not just for the characters and the character arcs and their stories, but just like little things that are callbacks that if you're not paying attention, that you maybe discover later. We mentioned Fulci's, the restaurant. Well, when it's brought up in conversation, they say it's the place that serves the fish. When Sean opens the phone book, if you actually read the phone book, it says the place that serves all the fish. And it's just like those little touches. And you can kind of see him ramping up for something like Scott Pilgrim later, where that kind of humor really is sewed in.
I think that's a perfect example of how the comedy in this is embraced by both the writing and the directing. I think that this is a hybrid film to the core that embraces both sides of it, because, you know, by the time you get to the feeding frenzy of zombies, it's legitimately scary. And there's legitimate consequences. Major, you know, characters that have been with us die. There's not just, oh, we're all flippity through. But there's also a deft handling of comedy throughout, if it's those attentions to details, but it's also this establishing of this very Edgar Wright style, these quick cuts, oh, there's the car key and then the whatever. And like now you recognize it so fully. It's like a language that you've learned. But
the slam zoom ins and stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And those are things that, you know, this was not his first, this is his second film, but the first one was made for, you know, $3 and as a student, like a bunch of favors. And I think that, you know, hitting hitting the ground running. That's a phrase, right?
Yeah.
Hitting the ground running with something that's trying to make as visual an impact as it is narratively entwined, as it is all of these other things, is really fun to see. You know, we've had like our Wes Andersons and our Quentin Tarantinos and other people who've tried to sort of build their own visual language. And Edgar, more than a lot of people, did really set that up. And I think we've also seen that flash thing replicated in lesser ways by many other people. But it embraces the comedy really well, his style.
And this isn't the sort of thing that I noticed for the first time, but it was sort of thrown into relief for me because this week I also had to review a new movie that is hitting theaters, wherever theaters are, this weekend, called Freaky. And it was a reminder that, yeah, horror and comedy can work together, but it's really hard to do it well, because Shaun of the Dead, like, can be very funny and very personality, or like very character based. And at the same time, like, give you that scene where, you know, Daffod gets ripped apart and his entrails, you know, consumed by the zombie hordes. And it doesn't take you, it doesn't rip you out of the rest of the tone of the film. Whereas Freaky, to me, feels like it's pinballing back and forth between like these really gory, like slasher movie elaborate kills, and then sort of like wacky body switch teen high school comedy. And it's not that you can't put those things together, but boy, you've got to have a really deft touch that Edgar Wright absolutely has here.
I think we should vote. I love voting.
I was just about to say that.
USA. USA.
Yep. Okay. All right. Well, let's get the vote going, and we'll start with Drea since she's so excited.
USA. Screen it. A. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a screen it for Shaun of the Dead. Of course, here it's a metaphor. Actually, not even metaphorical screen it. I don't know if that works. It's the highest rating that we have, and that's what I would give this film. I think it's so enjoyable and still managed to be really thoughtful and have evocative emotions, have a lot of fun, have a little gore, have some Queen while you're at it. I mean, it's got it all.
Yes, before Bohemian Rhapsody, this movie gave us a good way to use Don't Stop Me Now.
Yeah.
Yes, 100%. What about you, Michael?
I would agree with that. Screen it, absolutely. Look, to kind of follow up what Alonzo said, the intertwining of horror and comedy is difficult. But those two things are also the same side of two different sides of the same coin. Because at the end of the day, the goal of both is to control the audience's breathing. You either take them to a laugh or you take them to a scream. And it's a very difficult gambit. But when you pull it off, as Edgar Wright did here, it can be glorious. This movie is a celebration of genre. It's a celebration of the horror movies. You can tell that he and Simon Pegg grew up loving. And they did it their way rather than just be like, hey, we're doing our version of, you know, Night of the Living Dead. No, we made Shaun of the Dead but we also love this. And it's really cool to see that kind of love letter. And it really did rock the boat for the next decade with how you could do this kind of thing. So absolutely screen it.
Ooh, love it, love it. And Alonzo, oh. Actually stop the count. We're stopping the count. All right, Alonzo, continue.
Let them count.
Let me vote. For sure, screen. I wish I could remember who. A listener suggested that during all of this, we should perhaps change the top ranking to buy it on physical media as opposed to stream it.
Yes. But
either way, yes, screen it, buy it on physical media, whatever. I'm a big fan. I am, as we always have, as we've discussed numerous times in the show, I'm a big chicken when it comes to horror, but I totally am behind what this movie is doing. I love its vibe. I love how smart it is. I love how much it understands the genre and is tweaking it, and at the same time is doing other things with it. There's a lot happening here, and it's all working. So, yeah, I'm in.
Oh, all right. And you already know it's screen it. I don't even have to, I wanted to try and build it up, but you already know what I'm gonna say. As we speak, I was trying to see if there's a special box edition of the Cornetto trilogy. There isn't. Get on it. Maybe Criterion?
I would give a thumbs up. I'd green light that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be right back after we hear from another show for Maximum Fun.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is Wonderful.
It's a podcast that we do as we are married. And how's the ad going so far? Because I think it's going very good.
We talk about things we like every week on Wednesdays.
One time Rachel talked about pumpernickel bread. It was so tight. You cannot afford to miss her talking about this sweet brown bread.
We also talk about music and poems and, weather.
There was one... Weather? One time Rachel talked about Baby Beluga, the song, for like 14 minutes. And it just really blew my hair back.
So check us out on MaximumFun.org.
It's a cool podcast with chill vibes. Amber is the color of our energy. Is what all the iTunes reviews say.
They will now.
Welcome back to Who Shot Ya? I'm your host, Ify Wadiway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Michael Verratti,
Drea Clark.
Yes, and now it's the time we've all been waiting for, the Christmas Zaddy Christmas Movie Minute. Alonzo gets 1 minute to discuss every Christmas movie he saw this past week. So, Alonzo, are you ready?
And again, 13. I think it's so good. Just in this week, people need that frame of reference. These are Christmas movies he saw this week.
Since the last episode, I have 13 movies to talk about.
Oh, sweet Jesus. Oh,
boy. And most of them are like of the fairly disposable cable variety. If you're into the legends, the ones that have stood the test of time and maybe some that haven't, please check out my book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, now we're selling wherever books are available.
Some could call it an evergreen book.
Does that work seasonally?
Because I feel like you can watch it once a year. And the good stuff in it.
There you go. Okay, so on Netflix, we have Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, which is an original musical produced by John Legend. Visually splendiferous, a little overstuffed, but I'll take it. Dash and Lily, actually a series, not a movie, but really charming, fun YA stuff. Magical New York, and my friend Michael Cyril Creighton is in it. Yay. A New York Christmas Wedding, super queer Christmas movie. So if you're waiting for that coming from Hallmark and Lifetime, they've got one for you at Netflix. It's a little bonkers, but still worth a look. Over on Lifetime, Christmas Ant. It's a ripoff of Christmas Wonderland, but you've got Keisha Knight Pullum, so whatever. Christmas Yule Blog. I like the fact that there's some specific ethnicity because we don't really see that in these movies, but otherwise it's sort of whatever. A Very Charming Christmas Town, a great advertisement for Solvang, which is a beautiful city in California. Now, Hallmark, Never Kiss a Man in a Christmas Sweater, actually funny and charming. The leads have crazy chemistry. The Christmas Ring, okay. The Christmas Bow, pretty good. Good violin playing. Christmas with the Darlings, better than you would think from that title. A Ring for Christmas on Up, oh man, not good. Fat Man with Mel Gibson as Santa Claus, and Cup of Cheer, which is a sort of scary movie style of comedy. Good try. I like the idea. Didn't love the execution on either one.
Oh my god, ooh, he did it!
Wow.
Once again, undefeated, Christmas Zaddy.
Look what he's doing for you people.
I know. And of course, like it's been said, you can buy Alonzo's definitive Christmas movie book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, wherever books are sold. You know?
It's true. Much better films. You will not hear titles like Fat Man starring Mel Gibson in Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, alas.
Oh, yeah. Hey, you know what? Marion Jean-Baptiste's Mrs. Claus is maybe worth the whole effort.
Ooh. Yeah. Now it's time for some staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Michael, why don't you start?
Well, following off the heels of that amazing run of Christmas movies, and because we talked about a zombie movie today, I think I'll give you a blend of both. My recommendation is a film called Anna and the Apocalypse. It is a British movie. It's a musical. It's zombies. It's a comedy. You know, honestly, following Shaun of the Dead with Anna the Apocalypse is sort of a double feature. You could do worse. Like, they're definitely both good times. So,
Nice.
All right. Drea?
Mine is not related to today's subject. Before I say my staff pick, I would like to add that a film that we've discussed before and bemoaned how it's not been available streaming, Pump Up the Volume, is now on Amazon Prime. I adore this movie and have talked about it in the past, so just wanted to head that one up. My pick is an HBO documentary that I programmed at Bentonville this year called Transhood that I really, really loved. Largely, it's the focus on trans children, and there's four families that are followed for about 5 or 6 years by the filmmaker as their kids age and go through transitions and also just coming of age. Some of them go through puberty in that time or not. And it's a really lovely, it takes place in St. Louis, which is kind of a middle section in a very conservative area. And these people are looking for community and understanding and trying to just be good parents to their kids. And I found it a really empathetic and broad approach, but with a very specific target. So Transhood, I think it's lovely.
Mine was going to be Anna and the Apocalypse, but I should have known better that somebody else was going to get there first. Although, here's another movie that came up this week. So I have to say, like, I don't really get to dig into this in the Christmas Minute, but the Hallmark movies are being much better written this year. I don't know if it's the new CEO. I don't know what's going on. But, like, they're actively making fun of the old cliches of these movies, which I think is a lot of fun. And they're also delving into storylines that would have been verboten before. Case in point, the Christmas Bow features a flashback in which we see an elderly grandmother character who has dementia, and she's sort of out of it, sitting on the sofa, not really responding to things, until her granddaughter plays Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas on the violin, and she immediately perks up and sings the whole song. And that moment is really powerful in the film, and it reminded me of a great documentary that I helped program at Sundance, back in 2014, called Alive Inside. And it is streaming on Amazon Prime, and it is a doc about how for people with dementia, music is a sort of, there's a way to kind of, it's not going to cure them, but it's sort of the last functioning part of their brain. And very often they will respond to the music of their youth and sort of, like, you know, kind of come out of their fog because it's sort of the last thing that they can still grab onto. It's a beautifully moving film. It won the audience award at Sundance. And it just, the scene in this Hallmark movie made me think about it. And it is on Amazon Prime right now. If you did not see it, I highly recommend it. It's a gorgeous film. Have Kleenex handy, Alive Inside.
May I please just put in a small, just from this week, there was this beautiful clip of a woman who had been a Spanish woman who had been a prima ballerina. And she now has Alzheimer's and is in her 90s, and someone plays her. Oh my God, I could start crying thinking of it. They play her.
Oh, it's Swan Lake. Yeah, I saw this.
And
yeah.
She's in a wheelchair and she starts to do the arms, and it's the most beautiful thing I've seen. Oh, I'm going to cry again. We should get through this. I got to go watch that and cry again. So, yeah.
Oh, man.
Iffy, how about you? Can't wait.
Well, you know, this is going to be one of the rare. I've done this before, and I'm going to do it again because I just have to. Also because my staff pick would be one that I've already pitched, which was Train to Busan. But I'm going to break staff pick and do a TV pitch. I think it might have been one of y'all. Yeah, I know I'm doing it. I think it might have been one of y'all, Adrea, What's Good, but I gotta double down and say I may destroy you if you don't sit. And like Michaela Coel, who I've loved since Chewing Gum. She crushed it, and then she comes back with a force. It's on HBO. It's 12 apps. I had a friend who was like, I tweeted it, like, and then the next day he was like, I watched it because of your tweet. I'm on starting episode 10 now. Hope it doesn't wreck. I was like, bro, you went through 10 of those episodes. No. Like, they're an hour long. You've marathoned it all day. But it is that good. But it is like, after I finished the final episode of the season, like, I truly couldn't. Like, I just had to, like, sit down for a bit. And I went to drive to 7-Eleven, get some Topo Chico, because I just had to, like, let it sit with me. And much in the same way Edgar Wright is inspiring as, like, a writer. I think this has just changed the way that I'll write forever, because you could just, it just shows you can do much more and go as hard as you feel like you need to. So, definitely worth it, especially if you have HBO Max and you're like wondering what else you can watch besides Sesame Street. That's one. I mean, there's a lot of shows on HBO.
I know I was.
I know. You can tell that this is a dad saying it. There are so many shows. So far, I've used HBO Max to watch I May Destroy You, Sesame Street, and Scoob. Still sitting there. Every time I start to hit play on Lovecraft Country, I notice it's too dark out, and I have to be like, all right, I gotta wait till the day.
You sweet baby wuss.
There's a whole TCM section over there, if I'm just saying.
Oh, I'm going in. Don't worry. I'm deep. I saw that too. And I was like, Alonzo would like this. I'm gonna just go in and just pick one and then see if it's one that either you like or you're like, really? I'm just gonna go in blind. But now it's time for our 5-star reviews. If you leave us a 5-star review, we'll read it on air. And this one comes from A Genius Scanner. This is one of my favorite movie podcasts. The hosts are all very personable and feed off of each other's ideas in an enjoyable and organic way.
Oh,
you are
nice.
A genius. So much.
That would fit on our box cover.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'd say Casey would love this because you kept it short and brief, you know.
Unlike us, you made that nicely succinct.
I could feel him, like, a light tear came down where he's like, oh, got it all out.
Brevity.
So next week, we'll be discussing the second film in the Three Flavors Cornetto trilogy, Hot Fuzz, with our old pal, Ricky Carmona.
Yeah.
I'm getting the boost a little ready. All right, Michael, thank you so much for coming on the show. Is there anything that you'd like to plug?
Coming out, I believe, on VOD on November 24th is Deathcember, which is an international horror anthology, holiday horror anthology, that was produced out of Germany and has filmmakers from all over the world, and I happen to be one of them. And what it is there are segments all about different scary, horrifying things that happen around Christmas time. My segment is about a woman who goes to return a gift and she doesn't have the receipt, and things devolve into madness.
It already sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah, and it stars Tiffany Shepis, who is a known icon in the world of horror, as well as Jeffrey Reddick, who created Final Destination. So that's coming out soon. I made that over a year ago, and it's finally coming to the States. I got to travel with it a little bit in Europe before, the world shut down. And also, for people who know, not only do I do horror movies, but I also occasionally dip into the world of TV holiday films. And this year I have written a new one called Christmas with a Crown. It took a second because we've changed the title a few times. And that is a standard tale of a girl who's just trying to put a winter festival together when a prince pops by.
Yes!
It's
always the way.
Yeah, it's debuting on Super Channel in Canada, and then will be coming to the U.S. at some point thereafter. So Canadians, you get it first. My gift to you this holiday season.
Oh, well, well, well. Drea, Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show. Anything you'd like to plug before we get going?
Oh, I've done enough.
Yeah. Nope. Wear a face mask. Wash your hands. Keep your distance.
Yes.
Yeah. Please. And if you'd like to support the show, please visit MaximumFun.org/join. If you'd like to purchase a Jumbotron, go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message or $200 for a promotional one. Again, the number for the Who Shot line is WSY-803-1664. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, tweet at us at Who Shot Your Pod. Our Facebook group can be found at www.facebook.com/groups/Who Shot Your Podcast. Or send us an email at WhoShotYa@MaximumFun.org. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
Hootie hoo!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.